On this week's podcast, we're talking with Scott Vesnecker, who is Director of Global Projects for InterVarsity and was also the track director for Slum Communities of the Developing World during Urbana 06. You had a residential track, which is a little bit different for participants in your track because they all stayed together. They were kind of like in their own little world.
That's
inside,
right.
Urbana.
Yeah, we had hotel with about 130 rooms that we occupied, and I think didn't trash too badly in the course of the event.
Is this the first time that a residential track has been held during Urbana for this and some of the other tracks?
This is the first time that a residential track focused on poverty or in slum communities has been held at Urbana. There have been other tracks. Certainly the International Student Track is one that has a historic residence in Urbana. And then last Urbana we tried something called a mission integration track, last couple of Urbanas, where we got students who had sort of missions mindedness on their campuses rooming together at a residence hall in Champaign, Urbana when we were there.
So how did it work for the participants this time? Did you feel like they got the Urbana experience, but they also had this special focus that transmitted well?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a lot of value added. In one sense, it was a bummer to come with a group or to come with friends and then to have to be in a room with strangers because you're part of a track. And we tried to be pretty exceptionless with the students. If you want to be part of the track, you had to be in our hotel. The only exception was commuters. For those who couldn't afford a hotel or who preferred to stay in town, they could do that. But for the most part, students experienced the event together in our track. And I tried not to pull them out of plenaries or afternoon seminar times, so that it was by and large an Urbana experience alongside people of a like mind. So we had Bible studies together. They were awesome. Kevin Blue, who's the LA Urban Project director and also works for Servant Partners, was our Bible study leader. He did an awesome job and kept the reality of poverty or slums in his mind as he led us through the scripture, although he's very faithful, and we didn't bend the scripture to say what we wanted it to say. But at the end, he would make some wonderful applications for us, or help us to think in those terms. And then in the evenings, during small group time, we shared probably 45 minutes of kind of added material, although again I tried to keep content light so that they could have their small group times and be faithful to Urbana's quest to keep people connected to one another. But it was my opportunity to introduce them to people who live and work in slum communities in the developing world. And so, for instance, one of the evenings we had Father Ben Beltran, Catholic priest, who has spent 30 years in a garbage dump with dump site scavengers in the Philippines, talk a little bit about his world, his life. Likewise, with a number of other people, I called it My Neighborhood, and it just gave a five-minute window for people who live and work in slum communities to talk about life. That sort of thing was really powerful and added to our experience, gave a context, helped them to interpret Urbana and sift it through the light of global poverty, and especially urban poverty.
So this is kind of like Urbana squared or Urbana intensified?
There were some pretty intense pieces. I mean, you don't learn about 8-year-olds who have been sold into a life of prostitution without carrying some of that, particularly as the realities for people in that situation get described. And for those of us who have kids that age, it doesn't take much to start thinking about how radically different and heavy life is for so many on the planet. I think in many ways these are the darkest days humans have experienced on Earth, and some of that came crashing into the track for us at Urbana.
How so?
Well, I think as you learn about these things and wrestle with them, and one of the questions you're bound to ask is about the goodness of God as you start to put a face to the realities of global poverty, sex trafficking, realities of children at risk, kids on the street. And so on the afternoon after the, or rather the morning after the extended session, you know, small groups were moved to post-Bible study time. Normally small groups were in the evening at Urbana, but after the extended evening, small groups were moved to just after the Bible study time, about the halfway point of Urbana. And that was where I felt a good opportunity might lie in us expressing our grief together. So we had a corporate time of grieving. I allowed for another hard testimony after our Bible study that didn't have a clean ending. And then I said, you know, Jesus told us, blessed are those who mourn. There's some sort of privilege to mourning, that Nehemiah wept, not because he was sad so much as because he saw the promises of God unfulfilled and a broken Jerusalem, a broken temple. And that there's an appropriateness to lifting our voice and wailing. And I gave permission for people to wail out loud, to cry. If all they could yell was, God have mercy, then they were going to have permission to do that. They did not have permission, A, to carry the burdens of the poor. I don't think that's what would please the Lord. B, to feel guilty if they didn't feel like crying or wailing. That was, you know, you can't manufacture that. I wanted that to be genuine, and that people should be okay if they don't feel like wailing or crying, or, you know, enter quietly into a spirit of prayer. And finally, not to be weirded out by someone who was kind of looking out of control. And then I got out of the way, and I myself laid down on the floor and just wept until I was shaking with sobs. You know, this is the sort of stuff I've immersed myself in for years, and the first real opportunity to not fight back the urge to weep. And probably 100 students got down on the floor with me, and some of them wailed rather loudly, and it was a precious and powerful moment. We had a prayer ministry team there that really felt like there was an appropriate engagement with grief, neither manufactured nor excessively despairing. What I didn't want people to do was to take on the despair of poverty, but to cry out for the promises of God yet unfulfilled in those places.
That's a pretty unique experience. You don't hear many sermons on the Book of Lamentations, for instance.
You know, I did afterwards, I did a little word search on weeping. It was interesting. I found the phrase lift your voice, or they lifted their voice and wept loudly. Some of that is probably Middle Eastern culture, and, you know, I'm of German stock. I wish I had some of the Italian or Middle Eastern flair for yelling at one another in love and in anger and letting your voice be raised in crying. But so often we repress crying, and certainly any demonstrative, you know, loudness to our wailing. I think there's something healthy about letting that go.
Did you see that reflected in behavior afterwards, or comments and feedback?
Yeah. Oh, it was incredible. After about 45 minutes of wailing, I had to bring it to a close because the main session, the morning session, was starting. Interestingly enough, we went into a period of repentance, which I think is, you know, appropriate next step, because there's some of the desperation of poverty that we must own. Must be careful not to own more of it than we ought, but there is a piece of it that those of us for whom the systems bend toward, either by our complicity or our active encouragement of these systems, play a role. But afterwards, and there's some people who came late I confess, to the session, because they were dancing. There was a great release afterwards, and a number of students stayed behind and just worshiped with all their might, as if they were just relieved of the most painful burden that they had been carrying. So there was that visible response, and some of that is just, you know, you make space to be not self-conscious, and a lot of great things happen, I think. So that was one response. But yeah, numbers of people came up and said that was so helpful. Thank you for giving space for that.
You also had some special rules for people in this track, like no showers for students.
Well, you know, I made a number of attempts to create a touchstone. At first, in Urbana, the logistics people took this very seriously. Francis Friend, housing folk. I wanted us to be in a shell, to be in an abandoned building. Those who were at Urbana saw that St. Louis is a very depressed town, and a lot of shells of buildings lie around. They really looked into it. I'm pretty serious about pursuing that wholeheartedly for next Urbana, if that could happen. But for a variety of reasons, that didn't work out. I talked to the hotel, well, can we shut off power and water? Because, you know, not the whole day, just from 6 a.m. to 10 while people are getting ready. Because, you know, you live with sporadic power and water in the developing world. Well, of course, that poses some fire hazards and other things, you know, by turning the sprinkler system off, that kind of thing. Variety of other things. Oh, what if we just had one bathroom per floor open? You know, people just had to all use one room's bathroom. Well, I don't know. I don't think that would work. I just don't think students would do that, you know. And I don't know who we'd pick to sort of be the bathroom room, but it'd be kind of a raw deal for those who lived in that room. But that's the reality in slum communities. Still, it felt like, gosh, I don't know that we'd get very good participation there. Well, what if we called for a fast of showers and gave them buckets? So a bunch of us went out that morning that people were registering and picked up about 100 buckets because we had rooms of 3, 4, and 5 people, so the whole track more or less fit in this, in 100 rooms. Some of them were really raunchy. I mean, we had to scrape to get, and still, a lot of them are left with garbage or kind of a skanky look to them. But again, that's sort of the reality. And the truth is that people without access to water are forced to use about a gallon a day per person. Now that's cooking and washing and drinking and all sorts of stuff. We were just suggesting that as a sort of rule of thumb. But I also encourage people not to do it if their heart wasn't in it. If it felt forced, that's not really a fast. You know, enjoy a good hot shower, even if all your roommates are doing this bucket thing. And roommates, please don't make the person who's taking a shower feel like they're like you're a super Christian and they're, you know, a fat lazy one. If your heart allows you to, it's going to be a privilege and a joy to do that. And engage it like that. Engage it as a privilege and a joy to pray for the water situation. I've tried to tell a couple stories of people who have to collect their water every day, tote it in, and use it, you know, in a way that where they don't have tap access in their home. So it was offered, really, as a privilege to undertake if you wanted to, and a voluntary one. And I think people really got into it. I think people really tried to pray for the situation of those without access to water, think about water usage, and then to engage this touchstone of reality with people in poverty.
So how was it embraced? What kind of feedback did you get on it?
I think mostly it was embraced as a little window on life for people who live without access to running water. Of course, they filled up their buckets with running water from their tap. I didn't make them tote it from outside. But, you know, 65-degree room temperature water on a 96-degree body is quite a, shall we say, refreshing experience. And just enlivens you, gets you thinking and praying, and for the most part. Well, without exception, I didn't hear of any complaints. Maybe that's because I gave freedom to people not to do it, but I think people engaged it with joy.
Do you know what kind of participation rate you got?
No idea. No.
Okay. You had 500 participants?
Yeah, we had 500 sign up for the track, but, you know, if I counted in the room, I'd say there were about 400 showing up. I'm not quite sure where the difference was, but 500 had self-selected, expressing interest and putting money down, saying, I want to be part of this track. Mm-hmm. And somewhere around 400, it looked like to me, from our rough counts, showed up in our track times.
And I heard this was the first track that filled up?
Yeah. I was a little suspicious that I'd get even 200, which was the minimum to this. But within weeks, we had to shut the track down and create a waiting list. Some of that, I think, was maybe a misunderstanding in the early days as you logged on to Urbana and were given four track options, and it felt like, oh, I have to choose one of these four, and this one fits the best. I think we cleared that up, and I began emailing them to get those who didn't want to be in the track out. Mm-hmm. So we had plenty of time to sort of chase out those who felt like they had to do that. And I think we got a pretty solid bunch, but I think everyone was a little surprised at the interest in this track.
Well, you came out with a book right before Urbana, The New Friars. How did that interface with this whole experience? Did it generate more interest in the track?
I don't think so. I don't think the book was out long enough. The track was closed when the book came out.
Okay.
And I didn't mention it from up front because it felt a little self-serving, and it was a book of the day, so it was going to get exposure. But I sincerely believe that we had people who are part of the movement that I write about, this emerging movement of young people who are on this quest to live deeply spiritual lives in impoverished situations, in the spirit of St. Francis. Those kind of people were in this track.
That's a part of this postmodern culture that we live in now. It's wanting to experience life in an intense way, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, there's a spirituality in moving out of the academic and clinical into the messiness of people's lives. And I think people are hungry for that. I think we've lived in the West such an insular existence that people are getting more and more famished for a connection with the majority world that lives such a radically different experience than us.
We live a life that is polished and ordered and manipulated, and people are looking for authenticity.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they recognize the cocoon and are eager to get out.
Okay. And so that's part of the responsive chord for this book. How have you gotten information from InterVarsity Press on how well it's doing, aside from being Book of the Day in Urbana?
A little bit. By my reckonings, in these first couple months that it's been out, there have been about 2,500 purchased, this is really the first book I've done. I edited a book, but so I don't know how to gauge that, but it seems like it's been well received. It was a little bit of a wake-up call when my very first Amazon.com review was dismally boring, works-based, one star. I thought, oh, well, that's helpful. That is helpful for me to keep from getting too big-headed about writing a book. Since then, a couple more positive reviews. from friends, I'm afraid, mm-hmm. have come up. But so the stuff I've been getting been mostly positive. For some, it does feel a bit heavy. You know, I do talk about some awful things, and I talk about people who are living a life of engagement with the poor that might feel a little workspace. I really do try hard not to make it like, okay, if you're a Navy SEAL type Christian, you're going to do this, and the rest of us schmucks who, you know, can't hack it, we can pray for you. Mm-hmm. You know, Francis, St. Francis, was never disparaging of the rich. He was always gracious and did not create a two-tiered Christianity. Really tried to avoid that, because I'm not called to live in slum communities, and that was the awkwardness of writing this thing. Mm-hmm. It was a struggle for me often. I was always battling the internal, who are you to be writing about this? I've experienced some of it. I've done, you know, summers with my family among the poor, but a lifestyle of living in developing world urban poverty is not a calling I believe God has given me. So I think I was able to write with that gracious mm-hmm. tone to honor what God's doing, feel a sense of connection or calling to walk alongside them while not feeling a specific call to enter into that kind of ministry.
So you feel a stirring from God in this area, but not a call. It's two separate things there.
I really think you need to hear pretty specifically from God on this one. I think he's doing something. I think it's amazing. I think his spirit is actively stirring up people to take some pretty radical steps. But I do think you need to be hearing from him. And so what I often call students to is for a couple of years. Why don't you do a couple of years walking alongside the poor as a kind of novitiate? That's what the monks called spending a couple years in the order before you take the vows. I guess what I'm really doing is calling university students into a monastic novitiate in an attempt to discern whether or not they might be part of what I believe God's doing in calling people to make fairly serious radical vows in order to reach people who are cut off from the gospel and cut out of the power systems of this world.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard back from anybody who is obviously one of these people and didn't realize that there was this larger movement going on? They thought they were the only ones?
Yeah, it was great in the track to have agencies who do what I call, or what they call, incarnational ministry among the poor. That is, placing their people, a number of them don't even use the word missionary because they believe it's too loaded down with baggage, workers or, I don't know, Jesus followers, living in and among desperately poor people. Finding one another and connecting with one another at Urbana in this track, purposefully inviting them to be the seminar presenters, was great for them. And I think they felt greatly encouraged to be connected with others. Because for the most part, this is a disparate movement. This is not one that's going to, I think, come under any sort of overarching structure. Mm-hmm. A lot of small groups living and serving in slum communities that aren't connected with one another except to know a little bit about one another. But to be in the same room together was great for a number of them. Mm.
So that's one of the differences between the new friars and the friars of history. They had their monastic orders with a certain amount of regimentation and organization, and today they're independent for the most part.
Yeah, it remains to be seen. And there are a number of these, what I would call orders, growing up amongst developing world Christians. People born into slum communities, finding Christ, walking with him, and then themselves wanting to be sent out, though they now have access, some of them, into sort of the privileged class, wanting to say no to that and be sent out to another slum community in another country that needs church planting or that needs kingdom bringers, transformational workers among the poor. So there's a growing association of these developing world people that a guy named Viv Craig's trying to pull together under a banner he calls Encarnacio. It's the Portuguese for incarnation, because a number of these are Brazilian slum dwellers who are forming these movements. There may be a time for Westerners to have some sort of alliance or affiliation. I think for the most part it will be a very independent, somewhat scattered work.
It could have a connection point at Urbana every 3 years.
That would be great to see a rallying point, because I think Urbana is sensitive to the realities of poverty, issues of shalom being kingdom issues, being missional issues. And so Urbana's been great at engaging that throughout history. I think more earnestly in this last one. So it might be that Urbana becomes a touchstone for Western workers, incarnational workers among the poor.
You contribute to this movement as director of global projects by sending out groups every year as part of your role here at InterVarsity. You're also an ordained pastor. You do some work in the local church in Madison. Does that interact with this also?
A little bit. I'm part of a teaching team. We have a church where there's no senior pastor, led by a team of elders, taught by a team. So I take a slice. I'm teaching this Sunday. We're going through Philippians. And, of course, the teaching team wanted to give me the passage in Philippians 4. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, living in plenty or in want. Oh, yeah. That's sort of Scott's platform. He ought to take this passage as we're working through Philippians 4. So there is some of that that enters into my teaching.
Okay. That's the Faith Community Bible Church?
Faith Community Bible Church in Madison, yeah.
Okay. Has there been any reaction from the church community to the book or to these issues as you bring them up?
Yeah. I think our church loves the broken things of this world and has an affinity to them. One of the agencies, Word Made Flesh, has a number of celebration disciplines. They list them out. One of their celebration disciplines is brokenness. And they will distinguish that from woundedness. Maybe that feels a little semantic, but the reality of our brokenness is something that they call their workers to press into, to embrace, to celebrate to a certain extent, because it's in our brokenness that we find Christ. And so in that regard, this is a church that seems drawn to broken things, people with severe brokenness mentally, emotionally, physically, and has a penchant to reaching out toward broken people. So there are a number in the church who have picked up the book and seem to resonate with
mm-hmm.
it.
Okay. When did you originally feel the spark for this book start to glow? What was it that got your attention about this movement originally?
I would say it was in the fall of 99, as I was completing my master's program with William Carey International University on global civilizations. One foci of the final semester was the modern mission movement, and within that, urbanization was a piece. And so we studied urbanization. We studied people like Viv Craig, who had this radical idea of moving into slum and essentially denouncing his wealth. Although, anyone from the West with a Western passport can't completely get away from their wealth. It's not totally possible. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that they can, like Viv, people are doing that. It was Viv that inspired me. His story in Companion to the Poor and Cry of the Poor that started me on the journey, and many sleepless nights just sort of churning with this, not so much with burden, but with excitement. I really felt like the Spirit of God was touching this area of the church, and it percolated a number of years. I had at least one attempt to write the book and pitch it and had it turned down. That took the wind out of my sails for a bit, but I couldn't not write it for too long before it just started coming forth. And it was Jim and Beth Tebbe who said, "I think this is a book of the day. I think you're touching on something that's a reality for people in the 21st century who will show up at Urbana." And of course that got all sorts of publishers interested in printing it, because when you make a Urbana book of the day, you guarantee a certain number of sales just by that exposure.
I heard that it sold out in the Urbana bookstore also, even though it was Urbana book of the day.
Well, yeah, I heard that too, but I think that's a little bit of a misnomer. It sold out in the bookstore, so they tapped into the supply that they had set aside for the book of the day. So it seemed to be really well received. Again, I don't know how to gauge these things, but it was a little weird to walk by someone reading the book. You feel a little self-conscious. But yeah, it's been pretty well received.
I think that covers all the questions I can think of right now. Is there anything else about this that you would think needed to be mentioned?
I don't remember if I tell this story in the book or not. I think I do. Francis is walking by a very ornate cathedral with one of Franciscan brothers. And the brother remarks to Francis, "The church can no longer say, 'Silver and gold have I not,'" referring to Peter's comment to the beggar at the beautiful gate in Acts 3, I think it was. And Francis remarks back, "Neither can she say, 'Rise, take your mat and walk.'" It was just this poignant exchange that seemed to suggest that as the church grows in her power and wealth, she loses a spiritual power. I think that's happened to a large degree, and I think what I'm seeing are people who are ready to forsake opportunity in exchange for a different kind of spirituality and another kind of power that comes from self-denial, relying on God, making yourself dependent on Him, and maybe even dependent on the community that you're serving. That's what Jesus did, in essence, by stripping the disciples of the things that normally you'd take on a journey. He wanted them to be dependent on God and on the people they served. I think that's part of this quest for spirituality and a mission that has meaning.
Yeah. There's no question that that's what a lot of people are looking for when they become Christians. I was thinking about, I think it was John Wimber, you know, after he became a Christian, said, "Well, when do the miracles start?" They're looking for that power.
Right. Yeah. Some of that may have been bled out of us by the Enlightenment. But to a certain degree, I think it's because we've become so self-reliant.
Yeah. We're ready to compromise instead of sit back and watch God do what He could do.
Yeah.